Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to the podcast. So this was a fun episode, as they all are, of course, but this one was actually a little different because it was an in-person podcast, and that's actually the first one of that type that I've done. So I got the chance to speak to Joshua Wang, who is a fellow finance YouTuber here in New Zealand, and Josh actually kindly made the drive down from Auckland to me here in Hamilton. So really fun conversation. We had a few technical difficulties and actually ended up recording the podcast just through the one microphone. So we're both sort of in a little room crowded around the one microphone, as you can probably picture in your head. And Josh actually also very kindly gave me a gift during this episode as well, which you'll probably see in some future YouTube videos on my channel. So the links to all of Josh's social media channels, so YouTube and Instagram and so on, will be down in the show notes for this episode. So to be sure to give him a follow there. In this particular recording, we covered Josh's background in finance and introduction into the investing world, and basically his journey to putting that on YouTube, and also talked about some of his sort of core investments around retirement villages of all things here in New Zealand, and also some of his more speculative investments, including things like Pokemon cards, which you may find interesting as well. So without further ado, let's roll the episode, and I hope you enjoy. Josh, welcome to the podcast and welcome to Hamilton.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. No. Always good to be back in the Tron.
Yeah, for sure. This is the first in-person podcast I've done, and we should have done a video version, but for anyone listening, we're like crowded around one microphone because we couldn't get Josh's microphone to work with my laptop. So we're sort of sitting sideways, awkwardly looking at each other. But this should be fun. We don't have to battle with the 2 second Zoom lag, which I usually do. So yeah, this should be good. So welcome to the Tron. Tell us a little bit about, I guess we first met through YouTube. So we've both got YouTube channels talking finance, investing. It's not many Kiwi YouTube channels talking about that stuff. So good to meet you in person. Tell us how you got into this whole investing world.
Yeah. So I have a background in accounting and finance. I went to uni, studied that, and I started investing when I was at uni. So I did a study in year 13, accounting. Nice. We looked at a public company to analyze, and I analyzed the warehouse.
Yeah.
So I decided that was like the only company I knew. So I had a part-time job, saved up some money, bought shares in the warehouse, and went down, and 2 years later I sold it for a loss. But I should have held, because right now
it's worked out okay.
Right now it's gone up because of the Rona and all that. So I have a background in accounting and finance, and I read a book when I was young. Rich Dad Poor Dad.
Nice. That's a
common
classic
one. A good first book to read, on investing, and that sort of got me thinking, how do I accumulate more assets? Mm-hmm. And stock market's a great way to do that. It's easy, it's low barriers, and just a good way to secure your financial future. Mm-hmm. So I started the channel in 2019. I posted a video on the Hatch group, and I think that's how you found me.
Oh, okay.
And then so then we started to chat, and so right now the channel is going well. I haven't been posting so much, but would like to do that once I have more time on my hands.
Yeah, fair enough, because you're back to work now, right? You were full-time YouTube for a while there.
Yeah, well, I did it for like 3 months, and then I had some contract roles.
Yeah.
And then now 2 days ago I started a full-time role, so
cool.
Won't be posting as much, but obviously we'll try my best.
Yeah, nice. And what's the... got any big plans for the YouTube channel? Any big projects you're working on, or just chipping away, trying to get as much info out there as you can?
Yeah, well, that's I don't have as good of a time management ability as you.
my time management strategy is just fill your calendar up so you have no time to do anything else, basically.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good mental model, right?
Yeah.
Just force yourself.
Pretty much, yeah. I feel like I'm working full-time and then trying to do like 3 YouTube videos a week. And I feel like if I stopped working just to do YouTube, my calendar would probably fill itself with other stuff. So, so
you'll start two more podcasts.
Yeah, probably. It's a podcast, good fun. I've met a lot of good people. YouTube, I feel like sometimes you get a bit isolated and you're sort of doing your own thing. Like, there's obviously the comment section, which is actually like a weird thing to not have in a podcast. I found you don't get a lot of that feedback.
So how do people give feedback?
I don't know. They don't. I guess we're just. I get the odd email and that sort of thing, but I'm kind of just putting it out in the wild and like kind of seeing how it goes. Like I've had people share it on Twitter and that sort of stuff, but it's really hard to get feedback. Like people can leave reviews and that sort of thing, but
yeah,
it's not like YouTube where people can just tear you apart in the comments if they want to.
Yeah, I'm just gonna move my chair a bit so I'm facing you more.
Have you had any dodgy commenters? Any haters you've had to deal with so far?
Yeah, well, I remember when I had maybe like 300 subs, something low. I was getting maybe like 20 views a day.
Mm-hmm.
There was one time when my views spiked to like from 20 views a day to like 30 views.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, cool. And then I scrolled through my videos and I noticed all of them had one dislike. So I think one person literally went to each video, disliked it all. And that gave me like 50% increase in views, which was a good thing because obviously when you have 300 subs and not many views, any view, you take those.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like it hurts a lot more when you're a smaller channel. Like I vividly remember getting to 100 subscribers and then someone unsubscribed and I was on 99. Yeah. And that was like the most painful feeling ever.
Man.
And you'll get the occasional negative comment or something, but I feel like you grow thick skin to it over a while. Yeah. And there's like, I think people tend to leave more and more negative comments like as my channel's grown as well, but I think maybe with smaller channels like people expect a reply oftentimes, so they may be less inclined to leave a negative comment, but then with bigger channels they're like almost, not that I'm like a big channel or anything, but they're like more surprised the larger the channel that they've actually replied to you. And then it's crazy how many times they'll leave a negative comment, I'll reply, and then I'll like suddenly turn around and be like, oh, I didn't mean to, like, whatever.
It's
and
not happened
like,
to me.
I've watched your videos for a long time, whatever. So that's cool. So why the warehouse?
Oh, I don't know. I think it was just to stop my dad. I was like, oh, why don't you research the warehouse?
Oh, okay. So it wasn't like assigned in the class. You got to pick your own.
Yeah, you pick your own company, I think. But yeah, it's a classic value stock, right? Retail, you know, low PE.
Yeah.
Pays a dividend, ticks all the boxes in terms of value.
Yeah.
But obviously the growth in 2016 wasn't very much. It was in decline and then now it's come back. So, it really depends on when you've gotten, no reason for the warehouse really.
My first couple of investments were, I think, Fonterra, just because I knew what Fonterra was working in the ag industry, which looking back, like Fonterra is designed to just basically pay out all of its earnings to farmers through a higher milk price. So even if they have a good year, a common shareholder who isn't a farmer isn't really going to benefit from it that much.
Yeah.
Even if they get they might get a larger dividend or whatever, but.
Well, it's the cooperative structure.
Right? Yeah, that's for sure. I knew Fonterra was a cooperative when I was buying into it, but that I didn't connect those dots. that might be bad for me not being a farmer.
Yeah.
And then I remember buying Freightways as well. And, the only reason I bought it was because the price had been going up like over the last few years. It was literally like Google Freightways stock chart or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's going up. And then I also recall looking at Main Freight at the same time. And I think Main Freight was like $20 a share and Freightways was like $5 a share. And I was like, Freightways must be way better.
Way cheaper.
Yeah,
right?
Way cheaper.
Well, on a valuations basis, probably was. Freightways, Main Freight's always expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. But, that's funny, just those like dumb errors looking back at it now. How would you describe your investment strategy? Because from watching your channel, I feel like you're spread across a few different areas. Like stock market's one part of it.
And even within that, you've got like New Zealand, Australia, the US.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So the YouTube channel, I have a public portfolio that I, you know, buy shares on Sharesies and show that every month. So that one is more of a dividend portfolio. It was initially meant for people to just have a good idea on, you know, safe investments, because, you know, dividend stocks tend to be on the safer side because they have that consistent cash flow. You know, tend to be not as speculative as some of the growth stocks out there. So that was the purpose of that portfolio, just to get people thinking on how they can, you know, structure a portfolio. So that just continued on. So I started with about $1,000, and now it's the so close to 20 now. I've put in a lot of money. I'm not a stock making genius, by the way.
20x.
Yeah. So that's a dividend portfolio. So I look for, like, you know, decent valuations, companies that can consistently grow the dividend over the long term.
Yeah.
So some of the companies in there, Oceania, the largest one, largest holding, also have Infratil, which is a diversified manager in New Zealand. And I also have my own other stuff, which are a bit more growth focused, just because I have a long time horizon and I'm willing to take the risk, and I can accept volatility in the market. So that's more on the private side of things. And yeah, so I think my approach is more like growth at a reasonable price, and
kind of like Peter Lynch style,
GARP,
I guess.
GARP. And also some values plays as well. If you know, if something's cheap, you buy it. So I'm not like strictly following one rule or anything. I think it's quite a, I don't know, like, not one approach, it's all fused together.
That's fair. Like, I describe myself as a value investor a lot, but like, that doesn't mean I can't buy Tesla if I think it's undervalued, which I don't. But, but if I thought that, you know, some high flyer was like going to grow even faster than the price suggested, like, I'd be open to buying that. So is that sort of how you're thinking about it as well?
But at the same time, I'm not shy to buy something that's fairly valued but is a good business. I'm sure your approach focuses more on the discount, you know, businesses, 50 cents for a dollar sort of thing. But yeah, like, for example, on that dividend portfolio, it's more of long-term compounders, and you might not be always, you might not be able to always get them at, you know, fair or discounted prices. So, but I'm happy to hold those stocks as well.
That's fair. Yeah. Cool. I sent through some notes to you on things I wanted to talk about in this, and one of the bullet points just says old people, which might sound obscure to people listening, but that was talking about Oceania. I know you've made quite a few videos, actually, I think, about retirement homes investing. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So Oceania Healthcare is a retirement village operator, aged care provider in New Zealand. And in New Zealand, that's quite a large, quite a big industry, aged care, because we have aging population in New Zealand, and there's not quite enough supply for these units. So the government doesn't provide these units. They kind of outsource it to these public companies to build, or other companies as well. So it's a huge industry with huge tailwinds going for it. And the business model is great. The government gave it a lot of tax benefits to get these operators to build units, because there's a huge shortage. And so they needed to catch up. So the business model is very tax efficient, and it screams compounder over the long term. So that's why I really like Oceania's business model. And across the industry, out of all the public listed ones, I think Oceania is the best. I have a video on that, looking at the comparables and things to look for when you're analyzing these companies. So that's also my largest position in the portfolio. Cool. It's around 20%. So high conviction.
Nice. And when you say it's like screams compounder, like, obviously if the population's aging that's a tailwind for Oceania. But I mean, if you were putting that in like percentage per year type terms, that's probably not going to be like 20% a year, yeah, you know, like right. growth and demand for these units, right?
Yeah.
Like, how are you thinking about that?
I know what you mean. Yeah. If, yeah, well, there's another factor involved, which is the penetration rate as well. Right. So how, what percentage of elderly are actually moving into these units? Yeah. So right now, numbers are, I think, around 15% penetration rate, mm-hmm. and it's actually increased over the past 10 years. So I think a good reason for that is something like a network effect. Mm-hmm. Like if you think of Facebook, the more people go on it, the more valuable it is. Yeah. So I think the same applies. Like if, you know, the elderly move in, they'll mm-hmm. bring in their friends, more people join in, and it becomes a village, a nice community.
Play bingo or something.
Yeah. Yeah, or bridge. I don't know. Bridge, yeah.
I've been meaning to learn how to play bridge just because, purely because Warren Buffett played
yeah.
it. Do you know how to play bridge?
No.
No. But there's like, I see like when I drive to the gym here in Hamilton, I always drive past the Hamilton Bridge Club, which I didn't even know there were clubs for that sort of thing. But maybe I should learn how to play that. I'll put that on the to-do list.
When you have more time.
Yeah. It's funny how like, you know, people in their 20s are like interested in retirement villages. Investing does that to you, right? And gets you like interested in some really obscure industries that you would just not care about.
Yeah. Why I always have a good time like talking to these nurses that work in these villages.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, why do you ask? Or how do you know like all these things? And I'm like, yeah, I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah. It's like, I'm trying to think of some in my portfolio, like in the past, I've been really trying to get my head around like car businesses or like Thor Industries is a good example for me of like caravans and motorhomes and stuff. Yeah. And you're like asking all these people at camping grounds, like how they like their new Jayco camper van and all this stuff. And they're like, why do you care? I can't see you rocking around with your family in a camper van anytime soon.
Not.
That's funny how it pulls you into these different businesses. And then more recently, I've been looking into Alibaba. We were talking about before this. Mm. All of a sudden I'm trying to understand like how different payment systems in China get used and why people like one more than the other. It's kind of interesting to just understand how the world works, I guess. Yeah. Pulls you to some strange places.
Yeah. Well, it gives you a better appreciation for everyday things, right? Mm-hmm. And expands your horizon, which is one of the good things about investing. And yes, you wouldn't normally look for like study some random industry. But if there's money to be made, then you know, there's a lot more incentive to do that.
100%. And talk us through some of your other investments. Like I know you've got non-stock market investments as well.
Yeah.
Even right down to Pokemon cards.
Yeah. So
what's going on there?
I have an online shop, right? So I sell Pokemon cards.
Oh, cool.
TCGshoponline.com.
There you go. Check it out.
Yeah, check that out. I sell Pokemon cards. I've collected it. Oh, I started collecting some sealed products, which are unopened products, 2017, 2016. And those cards have gone up in value quite significantly. It's probably outperforming the S&P 500, I don't know, over the same.
Have you got Logan Paul to thank for that? Or?
Yeah, so it's last year was a great year for Pokemon. Logan Paul and COVID lockdowns as well.
Yeah.
So that drove a huge boom. And the market's sort of cooling off right now.
Yeah.
We saw a huge drop in some of the prices, card prices. But I like the cards.
Yeah.
I like to collect. And so it's more so a hobby and there's also financial incentive behind it, but it's sort of a thing where you can't just put in 50 grand into it and try to flip it for 100.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause you know,
it's lots hard. Of small trades.
Yeah. It's an illiquid market as well. The higher up you go in value.
Sure.
So, it's a small percentage of the portfolio, but I was doing a calculation, like a stock take, and it's probably around like 5% of the portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, that's because I have inventory moving around. on the shop. So
right.
Okay. Yeah, it's not purely just investment.
Yeah.
Yeah. But speaking of Pokemon, I do have something for you.
Oh no. we definitely should have done a video version.
Yeah.
Of this.
So I have a Vivid Voltage Sword and Shield booster box.
That's sick. Is this one of the ones I'm like not meant to open for 20 years? Or
so I'm gonna pass this to you and don't open it for at least 5 years.
Okay.
So the current value now for this is about $220.
Oh, sick.
And well, the next time I come on the podcast, maybe a few years down the road
or something.
Oh, probably not. But I think that will outperform the S&P 500 over the next 5 years.
You're a legend.
So we'll keep track of the prices of the booster box, but
absolutely.
Yeah, just hold on to that. Don't open it. It's very tempting. Okay. And I think if you open one, you want to keep opening. So
yeah,
don't open that
box. I'm going to have to keep this. Not that I have, I'm going to have to keep this away from, small children. Not that I have any kids, but
maybe in 5 years, right?
Maybe in 5 years we'll have if this has gone up to $50,000 or something, maybe I'll let some kid open. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it'll probably go. I'm guessing in 5 years, I'd be really happy if that goes to about $600.
Yeah.
So right now the value is 220, right? So
yeah.
I think that will outperform the index.
There you go. That's a challenge. Will it outperform my portfolio?
I don't know what your intent are. You never say.
Yeah, that's true. That's top secret information.
I'll ask you after.
Yeah. I'm gonna put this on my bookshelf for my videos. I'll put that somewhere next to Poor Charlie's Almanac or something. I think I've got a fake plant up there. Like I occasionally get asked how I decide what to put in my background, and I don't. That's kind of like it's my girlfriend's stuff that sits on top of the bookshelf. So sorry, Anna, if you're listening, but I'm going to move one of your fake plants out of the way. Yeah, replace it with
this
Pokemon.
Looks way better.
Yeah, there you go. And then if people have questions on why there's randomly a Pokemon box of Pokemon cards on my bookshelf, then they clearly haven't listened to this episode. Yeah, so it's only for those in the know that will know what's going on. That's super cool. Have you had any crazy home runs with Pokemon cards?
Yeah. So in 2016... like there was a product that I bought maybe $80 worth at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's worth about $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's in 5 years.
Yeah,
so that's probably the craziest one. There were a few other Pokemon products that I bought when I went to Japan in 2017.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I was doing because it was all in Japanese and I wasn't a seasoned collector or anything. I just spent some money there, a few hundred dollars at the time. Brought them back. Yeah. So all up, I maybe spent $300-$400. Okay. And right now those products itself are worth close to $5,000. Wow. So it paid for the trip.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually realize this until I checked the prices like a month ago.
Yeah.
Some of the free cards that they give. So they give you like promo cards that if you buy a certain amount, mm-hmm. you get it free.
Yeah.
So I got 6 of those. They were worth nothing back then, but mm-hmm. I checked on eBay now, they're going for around $400 each.
Yeah.
So that's $2,400 just randomly sitting there. I didn't know about it. So sometimes you make money accidentally, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. Do you plan to ever sell anything or what's your strategy?
Oh, I think for those products, it's sentimental value. You know, reminds me of the time I went to Tokyo.
That's why the prices have gone up so much.
Yeah.
Right? All these people that were into Pokemon as kids, and I've actually got an old school like Game Boy Color with Pokemon Red sitting on my house somewhere still. So I was one of the kids playing Game Boy stuff as well. I guess everyone that was into that is like getting into their 20s and has money now.
Yeah.
And that's where all the demand's coming from.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Adults buying, like most of my customers are adults anyway. Yeah. So
I wonder if it'll be crazier when all those 20-year-olds are in their 40s. Or if there'll be like the next round of 20-year-old, like what are kids into today? That's what we should be buying.
Roblox.
Story. Roblox.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll write that down. We should back up the truck on Roblox and give it 20 years and we'll see how we go.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Certainly not a value stock at the moment.
Yeah, that is quite speculative. Yeah. That's fun though. And it's like, like you say, it's more sentimental value. And you've got a business running off it as well. It's not just
I don't, it's not huge or anything, mm-hmm. but few orders here and there.
Yeah.
Keeps me busy, I guess.
Yeah. You got something else sitting on the table, which is quite speculative.
Crypto.
Talk us through that.
Right. So crypto. I bought Bitcoin late last year in November when the price was about 16,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when there were early signs of institutions starting to adopt it.
Yeah.
You know, what's that company? Michael Saylor started buying tons of Bitcoin for MicroStrategy.
Yeah.
And then PayPal as well started to offer those services. So it seemed like the start of that trend. So I put a very small allocation in my portfolio, probably like 3 or 4% at the time into Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Also had Binance Coin, which has 10x'd since then as well. So it was actually quite a speculative thing, you know. Obviously, I didn't know it was going to do so well.
Mm-hmm.
But I see it more as an option play with asymmetry.
Yeah, so for a crypto noob like me, what was it? Binance Coin?
Binance Coin. So Binance is the largest exchange in the world, and they have a native token on their platform. And they pretty much have a smart chain. So something like Ethereum, you can execute actions on the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, on smart contracts or on decentralized finance, when you want to lend out money, you pay for transactions using that. So So Binance has done a lot better than Ethereum or Bitcoin. And it's all speculative. I didn't do any like DCFs. You can't do that. You can't really do an analysis on like intrinsic value, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why I kept it to a relatively small portion of that portfolio of my portfolio. And I always saw it as more of an option. You know, if people suddenly mass adopt it, then it's worth the few percentage points in the portfolio, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's fair. And when I said you had something sitting on the table, obviously cryptocurrency is all you can't have a physical Bitcoin in your wallet. So talk us through what you're holding.
Yeah, so I have the crypto.com Visa card.
Uh-huh.
This is provided from crypto.com, which is a platform.
Yeah. And you gave it to me before. It looks like a really high-end credit card, and it's like metal, very heavy.
It's metal and it's heavy.
Much heavier than my Westpac, like AirPoints, $25 a year credit card I've got in my wallet.
Yeah. Well, what benefits do you get with that?
It's just AirPoints, so it's so many AirPoints per $100 spent. Yeah. I can't even recall what the rate is off the top of my head, but
So this Visa card that I'm holding right now is metal. Rewards are pretty good. To get this card, you need to deposit or stake, they call it, $400 worth of CRO tokens, which is the crypto.com tokens.
Mm-hmm.
So you deposit in there for 180 days. And after 180 days, you can take your money back. How I saw it was $400 was just, I just wrote it off. You know, because with crypto, if you send it to anyone, if you have money on any exchange, it's not your keys, not your money sort of thing. So I applied for the cheapest one possible, which is this red one, Ruby. You can top it up using crypto and it converts it into fiat and you can spend it. So I actually went down to Pack and Save and used this and it works. Nice. Yeah.
So it's got Visa on it. So presumably anywhere that accepts Visa, which is everyone.
Yeah. It has PayWave as well.
Yeah.
So it's a handy card. You don't have to enter in any passwords, any pin codes.
That's cool.
Get rewards as well. So before getting this card, I never had Spotify Premium.
Okay, now you've got Spotify
Premium. Now I've got Spotify Premium because this card pays for it. They do a full rebate. So whatever I spend in a month, about $10, they pay me back in CRO tokens, $10 equivalent. So yeah, I've been using this card for that, and I calculated the percent return because I had to stake $400, right? So if I use this card for a year and, you know, get that rebate from Spotify, it's about a 39% return on my 400 investment. So
yeah,
if you completely write it off, I think it's still worthwhile trying it out.
That's cool. So the process, it's converting crypto to fiat regular dollars and then spending that.
So you're not necessarily spending.
Because that's one of the main criticisms of cryptocurrency, right?
Yeah.
That you can't actually spend it.
Well, until one day they do that.
That's the goal there for crypto holders. And would you, I guess it's $400 and you're sort of just writing it off. But I understand you have some allocation of cryptocurrency to your portfolio.
Yeah.
We talked about earlier. Do you want to be spending cryptocurrency or would you prefer to spend dollars and hold crypto?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
It really depends, right, on your portfolio. Yeah. If you've suddenly made a ton of money on crypto and you want to reduce that allocation, this could be one way. You actually just spend it instead of cashing out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a long-term believer in Bitcoin or crypto in general, then maybe not.
Yeah. Does that become some sort of, does that get weird with tax? Like, because you're effectively selling some sort of asset. Like, are you suddenly classed as like a trader and getting taxed on gains on crypto when you go and spend it as cash?
Well, I don't see it as your intention's not to make profit. You're just spending it to buy something. Yeah. That's my intention.
Yeah, you're the accountant. Right. I don't know. But
strict law, I think there will be a tax event when you convert it into fiat.
Yeah.
So I have to figure out that one, my few hundred dollars I've converted.
Oh, man. Yeah, because I remember I think it was when Tesla said they'd start accepting cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
I was listening to a podcast and they were doing the maths on, you know, if you'd bought Bitcoin and had a big capital gain on it and then wanted to use that to buy a Tesla Model 3 or something.
Yeah.
You're effectively, so in the US, they obviously have like long and short term capital gains tax, depending on whether you've held it for a year or not. So if you were buying a Tesla with cryptocurrency, you're effectively like selling that crypto and would have to pay capital gains tax on that. So it sort of worked out cheaper with some of the examples that they gave to just like pay cash.
Yeah.
Like, and not have to eat that the capital gains tax.
Yeah. Well, it's like you're paying it with shares.
Yeah.
You have
to sell your shares. Yeah. Because, obviously the situation's a bit different in New Zealand, but when you do have that consideration, in the US, like that, like if you take Buffett's Coke investment, for example, he's got all these unrealized capital gains.
Yeah.
And it's basically like a loan from the government that he's got invested and is earning money on, effectively. That's how I've heard a few people kind of talk about it.
Yeah.
Like if he was to sell Coke, I don't know the exact maths, but he'd take a haircut on that before he was able to reallocate it somewhere.
But would his performance... Would it have been better if he just sold out and
probably if he'd got out of Coca-Cola in like 2000 when it was at 40 times earnings or whatever, and it's basically at the same price now, like 20 years later, would have been well worth selling it. But at the same time, it was like in the dot-com bubble and he was sitting on a mountain of cash anyway, like he kind of is now, so he was probably thinking like, what am I going to do with it if I sell this? In hindsight he probably should have bought Amazon and be a trillionaire. But it didn't work out like that.
We all would have bought Amazon.
100%. You ever bought Amazon?
No, I've got Alibaba though.
Do you want to talk Alibaba?
Not really.
Fair enough.
I think we've talked about it enough.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Alibaba's like, I notice if I put Alibaba in the title of a YouTube video, which I try to avoid doing for clickbait purposes. I do try to actually talk in depth about Alibaba. Yeah. But those videos are just super popular at the moment. Everyone's looking into Alibaba.
Yeah, I see that recommended. I think it's because I've watched one and then they started recommending every other YouTuber's Alibaba videos.
Mm.
And... they all think it's undervalued for some reason.
Yeah. I'm in that camp.
Oh, me too.
But that's all we're going to say. No, I know there's another friend of mine through YouTube, Investing with Frank. We do the punch card investing live streams together each week. I think he gets like probably close to 1,000 views on a typical upload.
Yeah.
And he's got 3 or 4, I think, Alibaba videos now. And some of them have got like 5 or 10,000 views, like just multiples of a regular amount. Everyone's after them. And everyone's reading that Jack Ma book.
Yeah.
What's it called? Alibaba, the house that Jack Ma built.
I've seen that
everywhere. I put that on Twitter a couple of weeks ago of the book. And then I've got this like shameless cloner coffee mug at home, which is another one the Punch Card guys designed as like a Monish Prabhai thing. Yeah, Karan. Yeah. Karani. Yeah. And there was a guy that replied to that tweet like with literally his version of the same photo. Like he had the same book and he also had the same mug.
Yeah.
And then another guy replied and was like, I don't have the shameless cloner mug, but I've also got the book. And it was like this chain of people reading this Alibaba book. It's so popular.
So there's a bit of herd mentality going on there.
Well, yeah. I mean, like in this real niche, like value investing world, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think you'd find like 50 people that are very similar to you. Or even more, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I've been thinking lately. It feels like I'm supposed to be going against the herd, but everyone likes Alibaba at the moment. But I think if you were to zoom out a bit and look at the investing world as a whole, it's probably not like that. It's just the people I'm exposed to because I follow people that have, you know,
similar philosophies. We were sort of trapped in our own vacuums, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of funny, like it's a little bit the same for me with Seritage Growth Properties. Like a lot of the people that I follow also really like Seritage Growth Properties. So you're like, can someone send me some bad ideas about Seritage and Alibaba so I can get the other side of this?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. You know, discussion. Like, I would like to hear the bare case for it to avoid, you know, confirmation bias and all that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, my inbox is always open for the short thesis on things like Seritage or Alibaba or whatever. Especially like I've been researching it. I know you said you didn't want to talk about Alibaba, but I'll just say that's one last thing. Especially for me recently, like I've bought a little bit and I feel like that's kind of biased me like in my further research. Right. Like I'm almost like I'll read an article that has good and bad points and I sort of feel myself almost like only really paying attention to the good stuff. And I feel like you've got to take a step back and like almost focus more on the negative things. And like someone like Charlie Munger would tell you that you should be able to explain the negative side of something like that better than the short sellers. Like you should understand all those arguments.
That's this whole inversion.
Yeah, thing, exactly. Right? Yeah. Do you use anything like that? Inverting the thesis. It's probably tricky because you do a lot more New Zealand investing than me, I would say. And there's not a lot of people doing stock write-ups and short thesis write-ups
on New Zealand. Well, it's hard to short, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to short in the New Zealand market.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's no point for it.
Yeah. Which is kind of weird.
Oh, the only way you go short is you don't hold it.
Yeah.
Well, I think you can actually open up some CFD positions using CMC markets.
Right.
Fees are probably higher though.
Yeah. Do you know why that's the case? Like why you can't short in New Zealand? Like just something. I know short sellers get a lot of flack, especially after the whole GameStop situation. Yeah. But it seems like a healthy part of a functioning market, I would have thought.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, might be a liquidity issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because New Zealand's a small market and not much liquidity. If you get a short seller, it can quickly move the price.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it might provide more liquidity to the market if someone wants to sell.
Yeah, well, the crazy thing was, have you ever heard Monish Prabhai's story of his Turkish investment?
Which one?
It's called like Racist Logistics. It's like a warehousing company in Turkey.
I've only heard the ones that you've talked about.
Oh, you've probably heard me say it before then. But the market cap was like $10 million.
Right.
And yeah, so tiny little micro-cap Turkish company. And Monish Prabhai managing like $500 million.
Yeah.
Was trying to basically put as much money in as he could before the price just shot up. And there's so much trading volume in Turkey because everyone's so short, like has such a short time frame. He was able to buy like a third of the company without moving the price very much just because there's so much trading volume.
One third?
Which is, he owns like 30% of the company now.
I wonder if that's
crazy.
I wonder if that would trigger like any takeover code, because in New Zealand, if you own more than 20%, you have to make an offer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that's how the takeover works. Yeah. That's why you see like companies stopping at 19.99%.
Interesting. I know in India, he's been capped at 10. So there's a couple of companies he owns like 9.99% off.
Yeah.
But I didn't actually know that about New Zealand.
I might be wrong.
I've clearly never learned how to take over. It's never been a problem for me.
Yeah. But don't quote me on that. I might be wrong. There's not many takeovers happening at the moment. But I think that's why they all keep below 20%.
Yeah. Interesting. There are a lot of takeover guys in the 80s, I've heard, in New Zealand, but there's not a lot of that anymore, right?
We have the odd one here and there. So for example, Tilt Renewables getting bought over by AGL in Australia. That company wasn't around for very long because that was out of a demerger from Trustpower.
Okay.
So I think it's on the market for maybe 5 years, got taken over. We have had a few companies as well that had been taken over. So the NZX listings have actually shrunk quite a bit over the past few years. That's not too good for New Zealand,
I guess. It's not great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'd prefer to have more holdings in New Zealand because we have, you know, good treatment on dividends and we don't have to worry about like FIF taxation for overseas holdings and stuff.
That's a real cost.
Which sucks. I'm probably going to do a podcast with someone who knows those rules a lot better than me at some point just to kind of talk through that.
Cause I have a tax video on my channel talking about that.
Yeah, I will link that in the show notes. Definitely check that out. What do you have any like long term investing goals? Like what? I know you talked about earlier on the stock market being a really good vehicle for long term wealth creation. But is there any like any medium or long-term goals that you want to hit? You know, like I want to get to a certain, for like for me, for example, it's always been about not necessarily wanting to be like super rich and have 10 Ferraris or something. It's always been about like trying to get to a point of freedom basically and just being able to do what I want. Is that kind of how you think about it as well, or do you want the Ferrari?
Oh, well, Ferrari.
You'll take the Ferrari?
Ferrari would be nice. But I think the first step is that financial independence.
Yeah, for sure.
That is the long-term goal. Like there's no target amount that I want to reach by a certain age.
Yeah.
It's just, well, in terms of targeted returns, I'm trying to aim for 15%, so doubling every 5 years. That'll be a good, I'll be happy with those returns.
Yeah, if you can do that, you'll have no trouble on the Ferrari department.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think like the difference between a 15% and 12% is quite big.
Yeah, it's like it's probably a double.
If you compound decades, over like 30 years, so 15% will do just fine.
Like if you can, if anyone listening hasn't run a compound interest calculator before, I would highly recommend going and doing that just so you can see the numbers. Like that was, is like little as it sounds, like that was one of the things that actually got me like very interested in investing, was just running a real basic compound interest calculator and being like, oh yeah, the market's done maybe 8 or 10% a year on average, let's just use that as a starting point and plug in some annual contributions, and you know, if I retire when I'm 65 or whatever, the numbers were like way bigger than I ever expected.
Yeah.
And then you start playing around with, okay, what if I can do 12% a year or 14% or Warren Buffett did 20%. And then it's like, there's a lot of zeros on this number. What's going on?
And that's when you gave up with the ETFs and start picking stocks.
Yeah, that's fairly accurate.
I think that's what most people come to realize.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a good chance of you outperforming an index over time?
Yeah, I definitely think so.
Yeah.
And in your last podcast, you talked about the edges,
investment edges.
Yeah. And I agree with that. I think it's temperament, being patient when society now is all about instant gratification.
Yeah.
I think that that sort of changes how our minds work as well. So I think it'll be easier if you can be more patient than most other people. I think you could do well.
Yeah. And it's, I think you've got a lot of advantages doing it as like an individual as well.
Yeah.
And not trying to run some fund where you've got investors knocking on your door every month to ask why you're down 2% or, you know, that sort of stuff. That would, that would suck, I reckon.
It's the pressure, I guess.
It's the pressure, and it's the type of stuff that would make you deviate from a good long-term strategy. Yeah. Like you just sort of turn into a momentum investor with 50 companies, and then all of a sudden you're just the index. So how are you ever going to beat the index, especially after you take your 2% fees or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like a almost guaranteed way of not outperforming doing that strategy. So
yeah.
I think there's a lot of advantages to being a small nimble investor. You can get into little obscure companies in random countries if you really want to. no one's gonna care if you haven't made a new investment for 6 months. And no one's gonna care if you like got 30% of the portfolio in cash for a while and all that sort of stuff.
That's the good thing, right? Yeah, that's the good thing, I guess. Well, you don't really talk much about stocks that you own in your portfolio, right? So
yeah, I say that a lot, that I don't talk about most of the positions I have, but I don't have that many positions, so I've sort of talked about most of them, I would say, on the channel.
Not having the pressure to buy or sell, that's probably one of the better advantages we have over fund managers out there.
Yeah, and there's a few fund managers that have sort of structured their fund in a way to where they can behave more like an individual investor, I would say. Like Moshe Barai is a pretty good example of that, where he basically says, I'll write you a letter twice a year. The rest of the time I'm busy. I run a clear calendar and benchmark me over 5 years, not 3 months, So I think that's a really good way of doing it. And Guy Spier runs a pretty similar structure. And he, like, if you look at his recent 13F, made zero changes in anything in his portfolio in the last quarter, which is...
How many quarters have he not done anything?
Guy Spier. I would say if you looked at his portfolio like 2 or 3 years ago, it would probably be like 80% similar to what it is now. So he's like... He'll make small adjustments around the edges every now and then. Like he sold all the way out of Fiat Chrysler maybe 6 months ago.
Right.
He's like bought Twitter. He's added a little bit to Micron and Seritage and done some stuff like that. Mm. But, like Berkshire Hathaway is still like 30% of his portfolio. He's owned Ferrari since the spin-off from Fiat Chrysler in like 2015. And basically, like, sort of almost you can read some of his letters even, and he talks about how his job basically is to identify high quality assets at reasonable prices and just never sell them. That's basically his job, as he says.
Yeah, and that doesn't involve a lot of trades, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, I mean, in the early days, I think Buffett did something similar. He asked when he was signing the agreements, he said that you can't take out cash out within the next 10 years or something. And if you needed the money, then then don't invest with
him. Yeah,
I don't know if that was with Berkshire or the earlier on in the
partnership. Well, Berkshire, I guess, was always just a public company.
So right. So, yeah, I think it must be the
partnership. But, with the partnership, I thought he had annual redemptions, but maybe not. Yeah. He might have had annual and said to investors, technically you can pull money out annually, but treat it like a 10-year investment. It may have been something like that.
I read it somewhere. So.
Yeah, but there are investors like I think it's Howard Marks who genuinely has like 10-year capital.
Mm.
Like that's the length. That's the minimum investment time frame is 10 years. Yeah. And there might be some things in there, like if you are in financial distress, he'll let you out of it or something. I don't quite know.
Oh, that'll be good.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of like Michael Burry in The Big Short, how he just like closed all redemptions when the craziness was going on.
Yeah.
And he was sitting on his like credit default swaps or whatever they were.
But I'm sure that would have pissed off a lot of investors.
Pissed off a lot of people. Eventually, he made them all, they were probably already rich, but made them a lot wealthier.
Mm.
And then they still all left his fund anyway because they weren't that happy with him. Even after they've made millions of dollars.
Yeah, from you can't track. Please everyone.
Yeah, some people just don't like volatility.
Yeah.
And maybe he didn't do a good enough job of explaining what he was trying to do. I think he has said that in interviews before, but crazy story.
Mm.
And then did you see Bill Ackman last March, basically did almost the same trade as Michael Burry did in The Big Short, but with corporate debt.
No.
He made 100 times his money, Bill Ackman, with a small percentage of his portfolio, and it was a kind of a hedge he'd had on a few times that hadn't paid off. But yeah, I think he's running maybe like a $10 or $15 billion fund, something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe more. And it basically gave him like an extra $2 or $3 billion mid crash last year to deploy, which was like perfect timing. why Bill Ackman's been rising back in popularity, I think, this last year or so. Set him up well to launch his big SPAC and all that.
Oh, the PSTH one.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I know a couple of people that own it. So Jack and Karan from Punch Card. They both own it. I don't know. I sort of, the only time I would really buy a SPAC if it's at like a discount to the cash in the SPAC. Or I knew what company the SPAC was acquiring and I thought it was a good investment and the SPAC just happens to be the vehicle in which you invest in that company. With Pershing Square Tontine buying Universal Music Group, for example. But other than that, I just put them in the too hard basket and look at easier stuff.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. The deal is structured a bit weirdly and you might not be able to get like your warrants or stuff from Hatch.
Yeah, for sure. Like there's things like that. Like I had a spin-off I own Fiat Chrysler for a while and had like spin-offs in companies that were too small for the broker to list, for example.
So how'd you get rid of them?
They just got sold automatically, basically. So I received it essentially as like a dividend, but technically I received shares that got sold.
Yeah.
So that's how that kind of stuff gets structured, yeah. Unfortunately, I was a bit late to Fiat Chrysler and didn't get the nice Ferrari spin-off, which would have been fantastic.
That would be nice.
Yeah, that would be very nice.
Just send you a Ferrari every year for being a shareholder.
Yeah, sure. I think there's quite a long way. Well, there's a long waiting list for most cars, I think, at the moment. I was at the field days a couple of weeks ago, and like Toyota didn't turn up to the field days because they had no used to sell. That's how crazy short of vehicles people are at the moment.
Well, you have to like pay more for a secondhand one because you can get it immediately other than waiting for like a year.
Yeah, it's crazy. Used cars are through the roof at the moment. My dad was talking about just last night, he's got a vehicle that's probably 18 months old and he got an offer on it to like get what he paid for it new.
Yeah.
Which is just crazy.
Yeah.
It's like unheard of.
But it's the market that we're in, I guess, with semiconductor shortages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Presumably it'll all work itself out over time. But there's a few people out there screaming inflation, but I'm not entirely convinced of that.
Oh.
How about you?
Oh, well, I don't know.
Yeah, it's just too hard basket stuff, right?
It's like an economic thing, and I'm not trying to predict inflation or anything, but I think it'll be hard if they've increased prices. Mm-hmm. It'll be hard. It doesn't come down usually. Like recently, 1st July, New Zealand Post increased their freight costs because I ship out my cards, so I know.
Right.
Yeah, and quite a big increase, actually. I think, the normal postage bags increased by $1. So from $3.50 to $4.50.
Wow.
Yeah. So, maybe we'll start seeing some inflation hitting our prices.
Yeah. Do you think that's just because people are buying more stuff online?
Yeah. There's also a shortage of freight. Not too sure about domestic, though, but definitely international freight. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Because presumably there's some stuff where, like, the opposite is happening. Like, lockdowns and stuff have driven prices down. struggling to think of examples, but there must be something out there.
Yeah.
Like you would have thought used cars would be a classic for like prices just going through the floor because no one's driving anywhere anymore. Yeah. But it's been the exact opposite. It's like, this is like, if I told you, let's say I was talking to you a year ago and I knew all of the facts about like COVID lockdowns. I was like, okay, the world's inside. no one's driving anywhere. The Federal Reserve in the States and like reserve banks everywhere are having to print all this money to keep the economy afloat. Where do you think the stock market's going to be? Like, no one would have said we're at all-time highs, probably.
We're going to the moon.
Yeah. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Anyhow, should we get to some questions?
Yeah, sure.
So for anyone listening in, I put a Q&A post up on YouTube last night to get some questions for Josh for this podcast. So let's jump into that. Feel free to say I have no idea on these questions if you want as well. You can put things in the hard basket. I like to do that a lot. But first question is from Shannon. What do you think of the space SPC Virgin Galactic?
Yeah, well, I don't follow the company. Mm-hmm. I have seen a few videos on Facebook about Richard Branson and his trailer, you know, like of his crew, you know, with the nice videos and saying what they all do. But yeah, I don't know too much about the company. I know they're trying to make it affordable to millionaires to fly to space. But yeah, I don't know much about the industry itself.
Yeah. Much easier to understand retirement villages.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I really have nothing to add on that one. That's an interesting one. So, firstly, great YouTube username, Rupert the Cat and Family. And the question is, if you won Lotto today and won $1 million, what would you do with the money in today's environment when markets are seen as so overvalued?
Oh, good question. Well, do I already own a house?
Interpret that question as you wish.
In my situation, I don't have a house yet, so I'll probably put a deposit down for that. Invest some of that in ETFs, I guess.
Yeah.
Or any other stock that I have a high conviction of.
Mm-hmm.
And keep some in the bank.
Yeah. Just till you find something to do with it.
Yeah. If the market's frothy, as mentioned, then, you know, I'm not in a rush just because I've got a whole ton of cash now. Or, you know, I'll most likely just buy the stocks that I already have in the portfolio anyway, just increase the allocation and keep it the same, you know, my cash at 10-15%.
I saw this question yesterday and was thinking about it, and I really don't think anything in my life would change. Like, it's crazy that like $1 million used to be lots of money.
Yeah.
Like, that would be everyone's goal, would to be a millionaire, and then I can live off the interest, as people used to say back when interest rates weren't like zero. But yeah, I think I just keep allocating to not all the companies in my portfolio. Like, I've got businesses that are up and like I'm holding them, but I wouldn't necessarily buy them today.
Right.
But yeah, I'd add to other stuff that I still think is interesting. It'd give me more money to invest because I don't own a house either, but I've got like a deposit kind of set aside because that's something we're expecting to do in the next few months. And then the rest of it, I think I'd just slowly find a home for over time.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd do anything crazy. Like, I don't know, maybe I'd buy a boat or something.
Buy a Tesla,
you reckon? I don't know.
Yeah.
I've already got a car. I've got a work vehicle.
Yeah,
maybe if I ever leave the job, I'll have to get a Tesla. I'll pull a Brandon from New Money and get a
The tax credit now.
Yes,
$8,000.
Yeah, that helps. What's a Tesla in New Zealand cost though?
Below $80,000. So I think
for the cheapest model.
Yeah. Thing. So the standard range, I think it's about 76,000. So I think that cap was purposefully made so that you could buy the cheapest Tesla to get that rebate.
Yeah, okay.
So I think whichever working group decided on that probably wanted a Tesla.
Interesting. Because because you can go on the Tesla website, right, and you can like build your car or whatever.
Yeah.
And it tells you. I think if you get a fully specced out like Model 3 performance, it's more like
$120,000 or something, I want to say.
Yeah, probably.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's over 100 for sure.
Yeah. So the eight grand will help, but
yeah, yeah. But what you could do is you could get the standard, pay that 76, get your mm-hmm. credit, and then you could add on the self-driving or whatever. Because self-driving is another 10 or 11,000.
Yeah.
Think. Yeah.
What do you, I don't know that much about Tesla self-driving, but is there only certain places in New Zealand where that works?
So it's on the motorways. Yeah. You can only use it. So when I was test driving, I test drove the Model 3.
Oh, true.
And also a Model X, so yeah. the big SUV
yeah.
a few years ago. I test drove the Model 3 recently, and
yeah.
It was still the same. You could only use the self-driving on motorways where it's clear the road lines are because
mm-hmm.
it uses the camera to yeah, sense right. where it goes. Yeah, so can't use it in most places mm-hmm. in city or in town, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Do you need reception? You must do. Or is it just purely working off cameras?
Yeah, I don't know the technology behind it yeah. enough.
We'll ask Elon. We'll get him on the podcast.
Yeah. it's fun, though, if you yeah. haven't tried it out. I don't yeah. know. Is there a Tesla in Hamilton?
Not that I know of.
Right.
Yeah.
Have to try. Could be wrong, in Auckland.
Weren't they closing down all the dealerships at one stage there?
I don't know.
I thought they were just going to go full online, but they'll still have to have some facility where they get delivered to, presumably.
But yeah, they're really happy to have people come and test drive, even mm-hmm. though they're not in a position to buy.
Yeah.
I think they want people to be more educated just on the product.
It,
and,
yeah.
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 Interesting. Okay, well, maybe I'll allocate some of that million to a Tesla. Swami 123 says, ask him about crypto.com debit card and Oceania Healthcare. We've kind of already covered that. Do you have anything else to add on either of those two things?
No.
No, Oceania to the moon?
Probably not to the moon, but aiming for 50%. Yeah.
What's the retirement home equivalent of the moon?
Retirement home equivalent of the moon.
Yeah, like you'd say crypto would go to the moon, but Oceania Healthcare would go to the Bridge Club. I don't know. Where do retirees race to?
Yeah.
Or potentially.
Where do they go?
I don't know. The Hamilton Bridge Club by Waikato Stadium. Drive past.
Could be the one.
Go to the bingo room. Or they have like, don't some of them have the little like, indoor lawn bowl looking things.
Yep.
You can play.
So Somerset villages do have those.
Yeah. Nice. Have you looked at Somerset?
Yeah. I used to own Somerset.
Yeah.
Back when I first started
mm-hmm.
and then Oceania floated and didn't go anywhere in price. So
yeah.
Became more undervalued and decided to go with them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I think you'd like it if you've been in one.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a hotel, so they don't need to go anywhere. They're just going to stay at the retirement homes.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Okay, let's go with one last question, then we'll wrap it up. So this is from Anthony Hall. How do you assess the political risk associated with the relationship between China and the US, specifically around the idea of ADRs?
Yeah, so
this is back to the Alibaba situation, right?
Yeah.
So when you're buying Alibaba on the New York Stock Exchange, technically you're buying into an ADR on the Cayman Islands.
Yep.
Right. Which makes people nervous when they even say that out loud.
So it's a VIE structure. So variable interest entity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it stands for.
And what's ADR? American Depository Receipt.
Yeah.
That means.
So I think ADR is the share certificate itself.
Okay.
Like you're buying one ADR, mm-hmm. one share. So yeah, like you mentioned, I think it's an entity in the Cayman Islands and you're buying ownership in that entity.
Mm-hmm.
And how I understand it is that they have, you know, contracts in that entity saying that you have entitlement to the share of the profits of the company. And so in China, it's only locals can own it. It's illegal for foreigners to own
mm-hmm.
stock
or
ownership in Chinese companies. So that whole structure is meant to bypass that.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's bypassing that, I don't know if it will hold in the rule, like in the courts. So that is a valid concern, I guess, that one day they could just dishonor the contracts, or if they take them to court, they might not hold.
Yeah.
So if that happens, though, you'd wipe out trillions of dollars from the markets.
Yeah, for sure. Because there's other companies that are doing it, right? It's not just Alibaba. It's like Tencent, NIO, I think. Yeah. Can't think of any others, but Alibaba is not the only one.
Mm.
But it's strange because my understanding is Alibaba always wanted to list just directly in the US, but it was the Communist Party in China sort of put a halt to that, right?
Yeah.
I think that's basically what happened. And I think similar situation with Ant Group, or Ant Financial, as it used to be called, which was supposed to be like a multi-hundred-billion-dollar IPO, which got shut down. Yeah. It's crazy. So, I sort of just default to people that are much smarter than me that have bought that, like Charlie Munger and Ernst Rubai have bought Alibaba through that mechanism in the Cayman Islands. So part of me is sort of like, if it's good enough for Charlie, it's good enough for me. But obviously it's not guaranteed. And I actually did the maths at one point. I'd have to recheck it. But I think if you look at Alibaba just on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange and do the comparisons, the ones on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange actually trade at like a 2-3% slight premium to the ADR. So maybe there is some sort of like small risk being priced in there. Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah.
It's small chance that it ever happens, because they wouldn't want to disrupt, you know, people's investments and wiping out trillions of dollars off the market.
Yeah.
It'll just be chaos.
That would not be good for the China-US relationship.
Definitely not.
Yeah. That's wild. It's like, it's a small risk, but if it happens, it could be like a wipeout in that investment, right?
Yeah.
Could just go to zero.
Potentially.
Which is not what you want.
It could go to zero.
Yeah.
But maybe that'll be a buying opportunity for other stocks if
that happens. We'll buy Alibaba at 1 cent a share after it's been thrown through the courts. Yeah. But there you go. Well, on that somber note, let's wrap it up. Josh, thanks heaps for making the trek down to Hamilton, and thank you for my Pokemon cards. Like I say, I'm gonna put this in my
keep that for 5 years, and we'll check back after 5 years to see if it's outperformed.
If if I'm still doing YouTube and podcasting in 5 years, we'll do a 5-year Pokemon card check-in special and see how it's gone.
Definitely.
Very cool. All right. Well, thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me.
No, absolutely. If people aren't already following along with what you're doing on YouTube and Instagram, I think you are on social media as well, but put all your links and everything out there where people can go and follow you.
Yep. So on YouTube, Joshua Wang, YouTube channel, find me there, as well as Instagram, JW Invests. So there's a few fake profiles going on now.
Yeah, there is a bit of that.
So just be careful. If I message you, it's probably a fake profile.
Yeah. Josh will never message you asking for
how your investments are going.
Yeah, how your investments are going, and can you please send me Bitcoin to this address or anything like that. So watch out for the spammers. But sorry, the links. Was that everything? Josh Wang on YouTube and JW Invest on Instagram.
Yeah. Perfect. And none of this is financial advice.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'll leave all those links down in the show notes in the description as well. So definitely go and follow along with what Josh is doing. But Josh, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Good fun. All right. Cheers. Thank you, everyone.
Bye.